Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So, Guy, Nick Mason's Source Full of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Control Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason's Source Full of Secrets.
You did, and in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever
heard,
frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Source Full of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy.
Now, something has struck me as a little bit of a sidebar to today, which is that obviously in my extensive research about our subject, it took me down a rabbit hole on folk music.
Ah.
It suddenly occurred to me that if you listen to a lot of folk music, if English folk music was your historical reference, you would think that ye olde England basically consisted of towns that were just full of blokes who'd come from another town who were looking for a girl who a mate of theirs back home used to know well and just checking up on her, making sure that her hair flowed still down her hair, you know, and then going home.
That's the entire genre, is it?
That's it, isn't it? It's always, you know, if you go, please seek a fair maiden. I knew her well. And she's like, well, I would, mate. I'd look her up, but I've got to sell these turnips first.
You know? But and all of this with one finger in your ear. I was really into folk music, actually, I have to say. I went through a folk music moment. It was a bit Hancock, I think, you know. But I did like it. And you know, I used to try and sort of, you know, we've had this discussion before, make up music to old ballads because I had a book of old ballads, but I didn't know what the music was. And of course, our guest today was in Magna Carta.
That's right.
I thought he was in Pentangle for a bit, but then you said you thought he was in Penthouse. And
and we were both right.
But Magna Carta, and of course, he's been in with the Elton John band since 1970 blah.
And 1972, I think it was
Madman.
Madman Across the Water was when he became a permanent member of the band. And he's been there pretty much. He sort of dipped in and out. He's kind of, I guess, you see him in the way that you'd look at Mike Garson with Bowie, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but even more so, because Bowie was just, you know,
in an absolute fixture. Wasn't always there. But to be honest, it wasn't the big bits, he was always there.
Yeah, and that band was such a fixture, you know, with Nigel Olsen and Dean Murray and Ray Cooper. Yeah. And, you know, I grew up absolutely loving those records. And, I'd like to focus on that 70s period, to be honest.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, it's because the dive on this, it's a reminder. I mean, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road was one of my absolute favourite albums.
Yeah, Don't Shoot Me before then, you know, which was Elton's kind of glam rock album. I mean, there's so much. Honky Chateau. I mean, it really is an incredible part, a piece of music to be part of. And I played on stage with him. I don't know he's going to remember this. I played a few times on stage with him doing Saturday Night's All Right in Dublin and in London at Wembley. You know what? We parted as well. So he may have forgotten that I was there.
Oh, there you
That's
go.
My excuse.
Oh, well.
Should we?
Well, I haven't crossed paths with them, but there's a few near misses, but I'm sure they'll come up.
Yeah, they will. I'm really excited about having one of the great guitar players, British guitar players, on of all time, and it's Davy John Stone. He's changed.
That's right.
He's changed the pronunciation since moving to America.
Well, he's Scottish, isn't he?
Yeah, but he was Johnston in Scotland, and apparently, really a long time ago, he decided he'd be John Stone. Anyway, we'll probably ask him that, won't we?
John Stone sounds like something out of Game of Thrones, doesn't it?
Davy John Stone.
Let's get him on.
Yeah, welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I've been sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Ah, Davey!
Can you hear me okay?
We hear you great. We can hear you just great. Can you hear us?
Awesome.
Brilliant. So that's your son, Charlie, because of course I worked and adore your son, Tam.
He sent me a message last night because he knew that was coming up that I was going to be seeing you guys. And he sent lots of wishes and love to you. He's amazing. I mean, what a musician and writer and... And he's been doing videos for me as well recently.
I know. He does not that stuff. I've got to say, because Tam, I used Tam on the music for a TV series, Gary, back in the 90s. Right. Called The Young Person's Going For. I got Tam on an Ivor Novello nominated song. But he had this fantastic party trick he used to do, which is where he would play drums and he'd play a whole part with one hand. But with his other hand, he would ghost it. So he'd be playing drums with the John Lennon slapback echo.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Is that what like in your house, Davey? Have people grown up, your kids and you, just sort of playing music around the house?
It's become that, exactly that. It's so bizarre. But I mean, you know, I don't have any lawyers or dentists in my kids. They're all fucking musicians, artists. You know, I mean, it's great. I love it to death. I'm very grateful that, you know, I've got kids who are doing something they want to do. And, you know, I'm able to give them that opportunity and help them with it occasionally. And other times just stand the hell back out of the way, let them get on with it. But what you were saying about Tam is interesting, Guy, because when he was maybe 6 or 7 years old and he started really getting into music, he'd be sitting there with his little cassette player with a Beatles, you know, whatever album, Best of the Beatles. And I could hear him making drum sounds with his nose. He'd make like, you know, snare, like Ringo snare sound.
Beatboxing.
And he'd make it with,
yeah,
with
his Ringo nose. Beatbox.
Yeah. And I'd hear him in the back of the car and all I'd hear was this. So he's able to simulate those sounds in an analog way, you know what I mean? Like you say, instead of actually having the effect there. Yeah.
Didn't you make music in lockdown with them?
Not so much with Tam. We did a lot of remote stuff because he's in Cornwall. He's lived in Cornwall for most of his life. And last time he was here was probably 6 or 7 years ago, the last time he came for a good visit. But because of COVID and everything else, he's been isolating. And ironically, that's when I started doing most of my writing, when we were off the road, knowing that we weren't going to tour anymore for a while. So that's when me and the kids started mucking around and doing stuff together right here in the house. It's been great.
Oh, but well, I just decided to carry on the family thing. I went all the way to Manchester to take my son to see you with Elton at Manchester because I thought that was it, because he was at uni there and that's such a box tick. I said, you know, he writes songs, so you've got to see Elton. And it was just magnificent. What a gig.
Pretty good show, isn't it? That show was...
I took all my kids to see it at the O2 as well. You know, yeah. I mean, this is because Elton's been in my life for as long as I can remember, or you know, since I very first got into pop and rock music, right. and that really means you as well, Davey. And,
absolutely.
You know, and while this was still happening, you know, it was absolutely important that my kids, I passed the baton on to our kids, and said, look, this is partly who I am and what inspired me.
Man.
But also, I think there's a thing, sorry, David, but because Elton has always been so much about passing the baton. You know, he was the guy who said, George Michael, look at this guy. And he still does that with that brilliantly genuine love of new music and new musicians. You know, yeah. That must be a really energizing thing to be around.
No, absolutely, because he's always championed new stuff. And in the case of George, as you mentioned, I mean, he was so... I mean, I remember when he played me the first Wham album, and he was so excited about it. And I was immediately blown away because, you know, you hear names, and I've lived in the States for quite a long time, since like 83, full time over here. So I missed quite a lot of what was going on. But he would play me you guys' stuff. He'd play me Spandau. And he said, this is kind of what I want the new band to sound like, you know? So all the time that, this is what I love about music and guys like us who are so into what everybody's doing in the business or in the scene in general, is that people do pass it around. You know, you want to share what somebody else is doing.
And, what was it like when you started to get to the end of this final show? Was there a sense of countdown and loss? And
not loss, not loss. It's bizarre.
It's like going off to Dignitas, isn't it? It's like, you know, we've committed to this date ending. Bit, you know,
bit harsh,
cruel but fair. You know, it actually, for me, I kept looking at the audience and I'd see fans all over the place crying their eyes out towards those last, you know. So many, I don't know, the last couple of years actually, it was like that. But I never really felt that. There was one point, and I was telling my friend, I was having dinner with James Newton Howard, who played in the band back in 75, 76. Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. And he's done all the wonderful music scores for movies, yeah. You know. And we were talking about some of that stuff back then. And he was asking me that question. And I told them that I really felt it during the very last gig when we were playing Someone Saved My Life Tonight, which is a big moment for the fans and for everybody and for Elton in general. And when I heard Nigel's, because, I mean, our sound is great on stage as well as out front, hopefully. And hearing Nigel's kit and the fact that there's Nigel, myself, Elton and Ray all up there, we're only missing Dee, God bless him, you know. And somehow that sound just spoke to me. And I thought, we really did something special. Because while you're doing it, you don't really think that it's that. You just do what you're doing, right? You know, you don't really think, oh, this is going to be amazing. It's just what you do. And that's what our whole thing is like. And it's only been in the last 5 to 10 years that I've realized how much people have appreciated that music. And as Gary was saying, pass it on, as you were saying, pass it on to your kids, because it's solid music that will, I think, stand the test of time. That's a cool thing.
What I loved is your subtleties and your commitment to the original material with this constant changing of guitars that you do. And as a guitarist, you know, I was nerding out over, you know, the double necks and all the different, you know, Strats to Gibsons and the painted Gibson. Oh my God, that painted Gibson with the Elton's Yellow Brick Road.
Yeah, your
stuff
tech must be on his toes.
It was just
your
amazing.
Tech must be on his toes.
Yeah. He certainly is. And it's incredible actually, because my tech of, since 1986, Rick Salazar, who's brilliant. Unfortunately, he couldn't make this last 4-month tour due to illness. So a week before, I just found out he's very ill and, you know, he's in treatment right now. He's doing good. But yeah, he and I had such a special, you know, ridiculous thing going that only you guys being musicians know what I'm talking about, really. It's really special. And yeah, all the painted stuff. I mean, Rick's girlfriend, now wife, Tracy Loving, painted that one that you're talking about, the Les Paul that I used on this last tour. And on previous tours, on this whole farewell episode, Bernie Taupin gave me a couple of pieces of artwork that we put onto guitars. Wow. And they've since been sold off. So you know what it's like nowadays? People are going nuts for guitars that have been used in kind of iconic situations. So, you know, during my retirement.
Guy's got a special guitar with who's painted by go on, Guy.
Well,
your bass.
Actually, I've got it. It's just over here.
It's worth having. It's worth having a look at because it's quite great. a famous artist.
This is a bass that I did some music for a film for Damien Hirst.
Oh man,
he spin painted this for me.
Oh. Amazing.
We'll put a picture of that up.
It sounds terrible because it's got like an inch and a half of surfboard paint on it.
But how many guitars?
It's funny because the Strat that I played on tour, the painted one you're talking about, that was my daughter, Juliet, who she painted that for my 70th birthday. And I mean, she bought the guitar for me and painted this amazing, I mean, she's just an incredible young artist and designer. That's what she does. And so I've been really privileged to use that on stage. And I see people's reaction when I come out with it, as I'm sure you get from that. You know, people see it and they go, holy shit, what's that? You know, and I love that. People, other guitar players, you know, who go like, oh my God, what's that? But even regular people who don't play instruments, they see some of these guitars and they go, and it's an interest to them. So I've always liked that vibe where people are seeing that I'm not being flash about it. I'm actually bringing instruments in for a specific reason. And people seem to like it.
It's a glamour object to begin with, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
A guitar.
So. Absolutely, yeah.
The greatest weapon ever given to the working classes.
Yeah.
Anyway. but how many do you have? Because I mean, there's a big change going on. What is going on in that collection? How big is it?
I hate to say it, I don't know. I really don't know. I haven't a clue.
You're quite right, Davey. Frankly, I think it's vulgar to know how many guitars you have.
Yeah. No, I've actually just before we got on this call, I just got an email from one of our equipment managers who's telling me that all the gear will be back within the week. So I've got three separate rigs full of gear that are coming back to LA that I'm going to have to find storage for, because in the past, we've always had a specific storage center at the airport, near the airport, because we've been touring so much forever. You know, we've always toured a lot. But now I'm going to have
to... Is it one of those bonded things so it never actually comes into the country?
That's right. That's right, yeah. Exactly. But now I've got to get all that stuff out and plus all the shit that's been piling up for God knows how many years. So I've got a busy week.
And finally pay the duty on it.
Yeah. Well, I'm not paying it. Fuck that. Bollocks to that. I will not be paying that.
What's your favourite guitar?
Favourite guitar? Blimey. You know what? I love them all. I love them all, Gary. I've got so many great guitars. The great thing is about being back home right now, because I've got a bunch of guitars that I always keep back here. It's great reacquainting myself with those instruments that I haven't given much time. You know, I mean, just amazing instruments lying about. And I realized, my God, I haven't changed strings on this one for 6 months or something. So I love getting back acquainted. And also things like my sitar. I've got a sitar in the house that's coming up for 60 years old. You know, I got it probably 55 years old. It's the one that I've used on a bunch of Elton records and stuff.
Yeah.
Lucy in the Sky and stuff like that. And old mandolins. So I love it all.
That's the thing, Davey, because some of your credits on albums, and not even just with Elton, but with other people, it's like you have a list of instrument credits. You're like a sort of David Lindley character where you'd turn up and do everything, you know.
I love it. I really enjoy it. And I think that's why I have been used by other players and asked to play on certain things, because they know I can do that. I can deliver stuff. And I've always had fun, for example, with James, as we were talking about before. I've done a few scores with James Newton Howard, and I had a wonderful experience with Hans Zimmer, another good mate of mine, who I'm sure you guys
know from
back there, from the Buggles all that, from the Bugles, as I call them.
Well, he used to have that fantastic studio in Lily Yard, which was just like one giant Moog. It was amazing.
Exactly. And Hans asked me to do the Sherlock Holmes thing with him. And a lot of it is centered around banjo, because I play tenor banjo as well. And that was great fun. I love doing things that are a bit different. It's kept me fresh, you know, it's kept my playing.
I was wondering what the first record was that I heard you on, and I thought, so the first album I bought was Honky Chateau, and so it was probably banjo. You were probably playing banjo on that Honky Cat, weren't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Honky Cat, I mean, Honky Chateau was the first official album that I was on. I was a session man. Like 19-year-olds on Mad Men. Yeah, I did the title track and Holiday Inn, which has got mandolin and sitar and all these things on it. So yeah, that was kind of like that was the point when Elton obviously said, I want to get this guy in the band, because up to then it was just a trio. It was him and Dee Murray and Nigel Olsen. So he asked me to join, and that's when we all went to the Chateau in 1972 and January and did Honky Chateau, and it had all these tracks like Rocket Man and Honky Chateau. So that was the first major album where we started having that run of hits. It was insane, you know.
Can I say something about that album? And it's been just a delight going back and listening to them, just to reacquaint myself. But Honky Chateau has a thing I hadn't really clocked at the time, which is how, rather than just Elton sound, how immersed in what was happening at that time it is. It's got that real kind of Little Feet, Sneaking Sally Through the Alley period.
Yeah.
Robert Palmer.
Americana.
There's a lot of that swampy funk in it, which was kind of in the air. And it's the bluesiest kind of, in terms of kind of bending notes and stuff. Elton's leaning in a way you don't really think of him.
Right. He wanted to do something entirely different from all the wonderful orchestral stuff they'd done for the previous albums, with, you know, the unbelievably talented and sorely missed Paul Buckmaster. You know, it's incredible when I think about it, guys. When I think about Paul, and I think about Gus Dudgeon, who's gone, I think about Dean Murray. But back then, those...
I've got to say, major influence on me when I first got a bass guitar.
Incredible, right?
Economical, great.
Absolutely. And the great thing was, those albums, it was only Elton, myself, Dee and Nigel. And then occasionally we'd use Ray Cooper, who became an official member in the beginning of 74 or something, like end of 73. So it was only the four or five of us. It wasn't a whole squad of massive things as the previous albums had been. And that's what Elton had been shooting for, and it really paid off. I think also the fact that I was a multi-instrumentalist, I think that was an added factor, because we didn't need to hire other people. If we wanted to bring other people in, it was maybe like a horn section and a couple of numbers, or maybe like we used on Honky Chateau, we used Jean-Luc Ponty, played some violin on a couple of tracks and that kind of thing. So it was all just a very, very tight nucleus. That was a very fun part of the whole thing. And also,
it's a very simple album in many ways, isn't it? It's an Americana style, you know, it has, you know, folk music feel to it. I mean, we'll get onto your folk background in a minute. And Susie Dramas was my favourite as a kid. I mean, Elton singing on this, I mean, it's mellifluous, isn't it? I mean,
phenomenal.
The talent. Yeah. And I just want to mention how, you know, of late, I've listened to that live album that he did, the radio show, when it was just the trio before you arrived, Davey. And he's 23.
What a great album.
I've got to say that Gary has actually mentioned that quite a few times.
It's one of the kids.
So he's not lying.
Such a great album. And you realise a 23-year-old kid is just so full of talent. If anyone out there in music deserved to be a superstar for the rest of his life, you just hear it there and then.
When I heard it, I was completely blown away, because I heard it before I was asked to join, but I heard it by accident, because I was helping. I'd been asked to do Bernie Taupin's poetry album. He wanted to make a record just of spoken word stuff. And myself and Caleb Quay and Sean Phillips and a few other musicians made this really cool little. We were just doing stream of consciousness, if you like. We were doing like music while Bernie was speaking. And in the off, while we were between tracks, Gus said, oh, listen to this. We just did this with the guys in New York. We heard the album and I was completely gobsmacked. I mean, the bass sound of that record, apart from everything else, was phenomenal. And again, that shows not only how great Elton and the band was, but how great Gus was and the way they recorded that record. The sound is great on that record. Really inspirational, the whole thing. Yeah, one of my favourites too.
Let's stay on Hockey Chateau for just a minute, because Rocket Man, right? I just wanted to... I mean, what is interesting, and I wondered if there is a connection. Here's Gus Dudgeon, and we know he produced Space Oddity, right?
Absolutely.
So there is... It feels like that there's a link here. If I look at the lyrics of Rocket Man, I'm wondering if Bernie saw this as an up-tempo record. Did he see it as this spaced out, beautiful production arrangement? Anyway, there are a couple of things to throw in at you there.
No, it's a very good point. But very often when Elton gets Bernie's lyrics, for example, if he's not there and he just receives a stack of lyrics, you know, Bernie has never any clue what it's going to be like. He's always so excited to come and hear a playback when we've got most of the tracks done. That's always been the case. Rocket Man was seriously special because he wrote it so quickly. I mean, he wrote it in about 20 minutes, the song. And when I heard it, the first thing that I thought was that beautiful openness, the way it goes into the chorus, but it was in B flat. Typical piano player, right? It's in B flat. And I'm going, great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
But that made me go to my kind of folk side, or that whole vibe I've got about open tunings. I've always been a freak about open guitar tunings. So I decided to tune my guitar to B flat.
Right.
So all those acoustic guitar, there's about four acoustics on it, I think, all playing right. That chorus section. And it's got this sparkle sound, you know. In fact, that was probably another mate of mine, and I hate to drop names. Actually, I love it. Lenny Kravitz.
It's kind of what you're here for. This week.
There you go. Well, Lenny's a dear friend of mine, and I just saw him recently in Paris at one of our gigs.
Lenny
Kravitz always said to me, Lenny said to me, you know, he said, oh, I love what you've done, you know, with Elton's music, but Rocket Man, those acoustic guitars, is the most bizarre thing I've ever heard. So I showed him how I did it. You know,
right.
And and then the other thing was the idea of doing, you know, some slide stuff, really spaced out.
The takeoff.
You suggest something like that to Gus, and he's on it in a heartbeat. So those ideas, they're very sparse, and they're kind of literal. You know, when he sings Rocket Man, there's the... And also you've got the background vocals, which was kind of one-stop shopping, as we found out, because we realized that between the three of us, Dee, Nigel, and myself had this sound that was to carry on all the albums, and Rocket Man was the first example of that. So, yeah, it was a really special track all the way around, and plus, being the first number one, that was like, wow,
yeah.
What's this?
The thing about you, Davey, is, and it should be pointed out, well, listen, if anyone doesn't know, Davey has this fantastic Instagram feed where where he shows you what he does. It's brilliant. So brilliant. It's so just entertaining.
Thanks.
What's great about it is you're such a parts man, aren't you? It's like, it's not like, okay, the guitars are playing these chords. It's like this part, and it so often it fits between Elton's piano.
Exactly. I mean, who would want, I've heard it and you've all seen it, but you know, a guitar player blowing solos all over some guy's stuff, you know. It might be brilliant what he's playing, but the song is destroyed. Now, I've always been the kind of person who I'll put the song first. And what I do is to embellish the song and embellish the piano and whatever may be considered to be the lead instrument. Because really, I was joining a piano-based band. And it was only over the course of the first few albums that became... with things like, you know, Love Lies Bleeding and Saturday Night and Bitches Back, where it became as much a guitar-driven band when it needed to be. And that, I think that's the key. Only when it needed to be that, that's when it was that. You know what I mean? The rest of the time, I was having great fun because that's my nature, is to try and make the song better, make the whole thing better. My part, as far as I'm concerned, isn't that important. You know what I mean? I'm doing what comes first. To me, it's my first idea usually is the best one, and that's why I enjoy it so much.
It's kind of how you came in though, isn't it? Because you're a 20-year-old kid, and you can talk us through this, but how you get invited down to, they tried a couple of other guitarists and you get down and you come up with the part for Madman Across the Water that Elton thinks is, it just fits in with his piano,
right?
Well, how did you end up there?
Well, it was bizarre. I found out quite recently. So I knew that they'd tried the part with Mick Ronson, God bless him, another one I sorely miss. Okay. Mick was a lovely man. And Michael Chapman, they tried it with two great guitar players, and it just wasn't the right thing.
Because Ronson played on Chapman's record, didn't he?
Yeah.
One of his early songs.
And here's the other thing that I didn't find out till recently, that it was Mike Chapman, who I knew very well from the folk days. We became good friends, you know, who had suggested me. He told Gus, you should get Davey for this. And I didn't know that till quite recently, that he was the guy who said...
Was that at did you find out at Mike's funeral? Because was that a gathering you went to?
I know. No, I did. I found out... I can't remember who told me, actually, but I was so saddened to hear about that as well, because he's another one. How brilliant. I mean, him, John Martin, guys that I was close with, and who were just phenomenal players, who, you know, you always think, my God, I wish more people had heard that, but... It's what it is, right? You never know. I still champion people like him, and my particular favorite is the Incredible String Band. When I was kid, you know, when I was like 15 and discovered them, I thought that was it. And, you know, to me, Sgt. Pepper and the Incredible String Band albums at that period, that was the shit to me. That was what was going on.
That's that whole Joe Boyd kind of world, isn't it? With down at Middle Earth and, well, UFO Club, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing how many folk musicians came from that period and went into bands, you know, top rock bands like Rick Wakeman, you know, he was in the Strobs.
That's right, yeah.
Rick and I used to hang around and he actually played piano at my first wedding, which was hilarious. We were very out of it. And, you know, there was just that vibe. Dave Swarbrick, you know, was working with Martin Carthy, and all of a sudden he's the main guy in Fairbrook Convention. There was a lot of that. Henry McCulloch, you know. There was a lot
Wings.
Of... Yeah, it was just amazing. There was that whole circle of people who suddenly were in other bands. Because maybe because they had different ideas and it was going to...
No, I think folk was being embraced, wasn't it?
You're right, absolutely. You know,
the folk was being embraced, and then people thought maybe this has got more of a ceiling on it than being in a rock and roll band.
Yeah, they made the jump when they could.
Yeah, exactly.
You may well be right there. I love
so
that.
Davey, you go down to what studio? Trident? I'm thinking probably Trident or somewhere like that.
Yeah, for Trident Mad Men. Trident was the favorite. That was where we did Mad Men. But I was also kind of a regular at Trident before that, because I did stuff with Ralph McTell, who's another dear friend of mine. And we did an album or two together. It was great fun. I did Magna Carta, who I ended up joining for a year.
Great record.
Great. Loved that.
Great
record.
Well, and I must say, fantastically recorded records. Yeah. Beautiful arrangements. And the acoustic, because back then, acoustic guitars were hit and miss, let's face it, on albums.
Good stereo. Again,
those are exquisite, especially with the left-right balance.
Well, you know, that's Gus Dudgeon again.
What a producer.
You know, Gus was such... I mean, he paved the way for so many great things. He got it about acoustic guitars because, you know, I'm sure you guys feel the same way about the Beatles, because for me, that's been it since I first heard them when I was like 11 or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you start learning the riffs and you do all that and you're George Harrison mad. Well, I always leave a bit of George in the studio when I'm recording something, because to me, he's still the guy. I mean, we were chatting about parts earlier, and, you know, I think that's where I got my thing about that, about doing something that's going to be killer, that people will, other guitar players will notice, but will fit right in with the song. So the way he did acoustics with John, I mean, another one, John Lennon, God bless. We got to work with John, which was someone else. But I mean, the way they used acoustics, the way that George uses arpeggioed guitar parts in the back and double track them and double track piano. We were doing shit back then and having a blast because it sounded like the Beatles to us, you know, on those first albums. It was so much fun because obviously we had Ken Scott engineering the first couple of albums and all these.
Because that's
people.
The whole Trident scene, isn't it? Because Ken goes on and does Ziggy Stardust and.
Exactly.
Visconti, a surprise Visconti.
I just want to skip out of sequence here a bit, because I'm sorry, you said John Lennon, and I'm not, we're not going past that. But there's a story, because when you recorded with him, there was an apocryphal story I heard for years, which is that he came and because he was just so out of practice and everything, that you basically had to get his whole sound together for him and everything.
Well, not get his whole sound together, because, I mean, the way great guitar players are, you hand them a guitar and they'll get something great out of it.
Now,
if you work for John Lennon, I mean, I basically gave him my, one of my old gold top. I gave him my gold top, said, you play that, I'll play this. And because we did the Lucy in the Sky track live, and that's the way we always did tracks. That was the way, something else we're all missing terribly these days. But, I mean, we always recorded as a band. So I gave John my Les Paul, and he said, oh, what do you want me to play? And I said, what do you mean? I said, you wrote the fucking song. Play whatever you want, you know? I don't care what you fucking play. Play whatever you want, you know? And it was just the best thing, because he came up with that reggae interlude in that song. But we were doing... And the magical thing, the whole thing was magical, because we all loved John. We all
He could be irreverent, couldn't he? He was allowed to be irreverent.
Oh, absolutely. And we all...
I'm wondering if this is around the time... What year was this? Was it 75?
74.
Oh, it was 74. So it was... I'm just thinking... Because I'm just thinking of the thing between him and Paul. Because when Paul did Live and Let Die... Live and Let Die.
Yes.
Which had the reggae bit in it. Well, I'm just wondering if he's going, oh, yeah.
It's quite possible. I don't know if it was really... It might have been. Because the way John was, he was hilarious. Yeah. But if you remember, back then, there was a period that almost every single had a reggae breakdown. You know? It's like, what the fuck?
It became... Yeah, like, it's the in the 90s, it was the rap.
Yes.
In the mid-70s, it was the reggae section.
Exactly. And so... But it still sounds good to me. When I hear the track, I go, like, sounds great. And... So that was great. But really, on that song, that particular song, the thing that really made us all shiver in the studio was when he sung the chorus with Elton. And as soon as you heard Elton's voice on that chorus part, we all kind of looked at each other and it was like, oh, wow, you know. And apart from the fact that he was just a lovely man and funny as hell, we had a great, great time for that whole year. To end it up... by playing with him on stage, having him on stage with our band.
Madison Square Garden.
Just unbelievable. I mean, just an incredible moment all the way around. And all the way from the band to the crew to the audience, there was this atmosphere of what is happening. This is amazing. I'm so glad I'm here. There was that genuine
thing. But there's an amazing story, isn't there? This is an amazing story that goes on, because apparently that is the night that John and Yoko reconciled. And in theory, that's where Sean was conceived.
And she sent a flower, didn't she? An orchid or something?
Yeah, backstage, that's right.
It was
a gardenia, I believe.
Gardenia.
He wore it in his lapel on the show. You can see if you see it. I mean, criminally, there's actually not much film or anything from that gig, which is... I always wonder why that was. I think, you know, there was a period where I would think...
You didn't think like that back then.
Exactly. You know. It was like... Well, it was another aspect, though. It was like... Oh, we're too cool. We don't do TV. We don't do this. We don't do that.
Yeah.
So we just won't film it, you know?
Oh, yeah, okay. But it felt so... Rock and roll felt still like it was just what people do when they're young. And that we never imagined that 50 years later, you'd still be doing it and we'd still be honouring it. And it would become, you know, so historic.
It's amazing, isn't it? It really is. And I really felt that on this farewell tour, because it felt like... We're one of the last bands out there doing this, playing live to people, playing live music and rocking our brains out and giving everything. That's the other thing. We've always been, you know, giving the whole thing. And I've seen a lot of bands over the years who maybe kind of get disinterested and they're just going through the motions. And that's maybe if that's their vibe, that's fine. But we've always been the kind of band that, all right, we've been playing these songs for quite a long time. But let's keep making them fresh. So, you know, occasionally Elton would call me up like twice a week and he'd call me up after a gig and go, what's going on? He said, this is sounding better than we've ever done it. You know, and he'd be genuinely blown away. And I would too. Wow. We'd be going, I know this is just so much fun because we're taking it. We'll keep raising the bar for ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of people stop. They forget that you've got to keep doing it for yourself as much as the people and making it great.
Well, yeah, but because I was going to say kind of the opposite to that. Obviously, you've got to do it for yourself. But because the one thing at that Manchester show, the one thing that was so clear was Elton's absolutely genuine love and gratitude to his audience.
Absolutely. You know,
that's clearly always been. And he was talking about all the old clubs in Manchester, the Twisted Wheel. And
yeah.
And it was like the support of that city had meant so much to me. And he just wants to, you know, and all of you, you just want to give it to those people, you know.
Yeah. I think it's important, isn't it, to acknowledge your peers and whatever else is going on. And the people, of course, they're the ones who make it all work. Mm-hmm. They allow us to do it. People do feel that. And I think it's important to express it. Definitely. And that's always been a big thing with us, you know, and especially on that last tour. There was a lot of gratitude pouring from the stage, and people felt it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I just want to dip back into your formative years, David. Where did you, you know, was music in your family? How did it all, you grew up in Scotland, right? Edinburgh, where were you?
Edinburgh, Scotland. And the first thing that I heard, I have two big sisters. They're wonderful. And so they're 10 and 12 years older than me, respectively. But so when I was five, I was hearing, they had a little dance set or something, a little record player. But he played the old 78s, obviously, at that time. And the first thing that I really heard was Jailhouse Rock, their records, you know. So I'd be five, they'd be 15, 16.
Ah.
And I heard Jailhouse Rock, and I heard All Shook Up. I heard Heartbreak Hotel. I heard Buddy Holly, Oh Boy, and that kind of thing. And Little Richard. And I went, what is this? Because I was also hearing on the radio, you'd hear Frank Sinatra and other things. And I go, yeah, that's great. I know what that is. But it wasn't until I heard the rock and roll where I went, oh, you know, that's something that I want to do. I understand that. Ironically, I met, you know, I worked with Little Richard a couple of times way down the line. And we had the best time. What a great, what an amazing person. And funny
well,
guy.
Obviously, who better than you? I mean, you've got more game working with flamboyant piano players than anyone.
Yeah.
That's so true. But he did something unbelievable. I've got to slip this in so you'll like this one. We were doing a rehearsal for a show that we were doing in LA years ago. And Little Richard was doing Tutti Frutti, Great Balls of Fire, and Lucille, right? So I'm getting to play that behind him with our band at that time. We played, you know, we were backing up all the acts who were on. It was a huge bill with George Michael and Sheryl Crow and Elton and all these different, Julie Andrews. It was unbelievable. So anyway, Little Richard's in rehearsal, right? We're in rehearsal and we played Lucille and we finished it. And he turned around to me and he said, where are you from? And I said, I'm from Scotland. He said, shit, honey, you must be from the black part of Scotland. I lost it completely. And I actually I titled a track on my the album with my family, an instrumental. I had to title it Black Scotland. It's called that. Brilliant. Because of Richard. But yeah, awesome,
but how did you get into playing guitar? Let's just have that story.
So it was violin first, wasn't it?
I did. I played viola at school from 7 years old. And that was another one whereby, you know, it was an accident. I remember somebody coming around our classroom and saying, does somebody want to play, learn the violin? We're going to be starting classes. And my hand went like that. And I'm kind of looking at my arm going, why did I put my hand up? I no clue.
Wow.
So, but it, what it was... It,
but if
it,
you hadn't have done that, could you imagine?
I know.
Yeah.
Crazy, right?
Yeah.
So what it did was it taught me intonation. It taught me fingering. It taught me all kinds of stuff about music. So within a few years, I was, instead of doing this, I was playing it down here, you know. And finally, one of my sisters got me a guitar, an old acoustic, when I was, I think, 11. And that's when I started learning everything I could. You know, in those days, you listened to the radio. That was it. That was what you had. So, you know, I'd be sitting by the radio, waiting for, you know, Radio Luxembourg or whatever, waiting for a Beatles song to come on or a Stones song so I could learn the part really quickly. And that's how you learned back then. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it went very quickly from then. Maybe the next year, my dad was kind enough to get me an electric guitar and a tiny little amp. It was the worst guitar on the... But it was brilliant when I think back. It was called a Broadway. And it was £12, I think. Got this guitar. And I just kept, you know, advancing. And by the time I was 13, I was playing in a local rock band where all the other guys were in their 20s, and I'm 13. So it always was like that. I was like the kid all the time. Mm. But I was the kid who was going, have you heard that Beatles song? We should do that. Or we should do this. Or, you know. So I think my infectious excitement for music is another thing that's really helped me over the years. Because I was never afraid to say, well, maybe it should be like this or like that. And that's always helped me through doing session work with other people. It's given me the confidence to say, well, I really think that we should do that, or, you know, what about this? I'm not to try and offend somebody or saying I know better, but in some cases I've found that I tend to have a really good perception of what it might be, what would be a good place to start. And I've just had a lot of fun doing that. So the whole folk thing really followed when I found another idol to copy, which was Barney McKenna from the Dubliners. Barney was the banjo player in the Dubliners. And if you hear some of his early banjo stuff, you know, when I heard it, I thought that was it. This is what I want to do. So I had to go and buy a banjo. I'd go to all the pawn shops and find it.
That's brilliant, because this isn't something we've heard from a lot of guitar heroes we've had on the show, if we're honest.
No one's ever smashed a banjo apart from maybe someone in the audience who'd had enough.
But you know, it really it's the kind of music, if you listen to the old Dubliner stuff and the Chieftains and all that, I got suddenly romanced by traditional Irish and Scottish music. So I learned to play banjo like Barney McKenna. I learned to play mandolin like Dave Swarbrick. I learned to play guitar like John Martin and the Incredible String Band. And I put all that together. And then, of course, I had to get a sitar when I heard, you know, the Beatles stuff and all the rest of it. Yeah. And the thing was, there's a wonderful, probably the grandfather nowadays, I hope he doesn't mind if I call him that, of folk music is Archie Fisher. Yeah, you may have heard of Archie. Just an amazing singer, guitar player. I went to his apartment in Fife years ago. I got invited to his apartment. It was like going into a temple. Archie was like, you know, the man. He was the guy. And he was sitting cross-legged on a rug with incense burning, playing the sitar. And I walked in, I went like, oh God, I got to do that. So that was my next influence. I got to get a sitar.
Did you play sitar on Tiny Dancer? No, have I got that wrong? No.
Holiday Inn.
Holiday, yeah.
That's the one with, but you know, with sitar on it.
Yeah, but you
played... Oh, yeah, I played acoustic on Tiny Dancer, yeah.
But I can... There's a lot of snobbery in folk music, isn't there? Was there a moment when you thought, I'm going to leap into rock and roll here? Or did Elton not appear rock and roll to you? Because I think you mentioned about you were quite surprised when you suddenly found yourself playing live and it was a lot more glamorous than you imagined.
Absolutely. Nobody really warned me or gave me any idea what it was going to be like, because having been a folkie for several years and a session guy and not really a performer, well, not at all a performer on a rock and roll stage. I mean, if you saw Magna Carta, it was three guys sitting on stools and singing these beautiful songs and playing different instruments, fine. But to get on a stage and suddenly project rock and roll, I had no clue. And nobody told me. Dean, Nigel or Elton never said a word. You know, I had no idea he was going to start doing, you know, handsprings off his on the piano and shit like that. And I'm going, okay, what are we going to do? So at that point, I think, was when I started thinking, okay, well, if I'm going to be a rock star, I better start drinking a lot more. I better start smoking a lot more hash. I better, you know, do this and I better do that and wear stupid clothes. So Granny takes a trip.
If that's what it takes.
That's it. Yeah. And that's really what happened. And I decided to, okay, I'm going to immerse myself in this.
You had the hair. You had the hair. You had Mick Ronson's hair and all of that. You know,
yeah.
Because the glam.
Did you have to throw out? You had to throw out all your cable knit sweaters.
Yeah. All of that went. All the Fair Isle stuff. All of that went.
Yeah. I have a clear memory of walking into our tiny little kitchen. My mum was washing up, and I said, "Mum, can I have $1.99? I've got to buy Don't Shoot Me." And that was a glam rock album in many ways, wasn't it? Because that competition for Elton, what Elton's always been good at is embracing whatever's going on in the ether.
Yes.
You made an album that was tasteful, but at the same time had the sort of elements of glam about it.
I really loved that album. Like you say, the elements were kind of like, we were almost like documenting what was going on in music at that point. It was suddenly like, okay, if we're the guys, we've had this kind of stuff, we're going to start doing that. And the some of the songs on that album, like for example Teenage Idol, that was all about Mark, you know, because Mark was a mate back then, and it was really an ode to him, you know. And Crocodile Rock, which I've got to tell you, that record to this day, I love the record, you know. In some ways people go, oh, fucking hell, not that again. But when you listen to the actual track, it's a great, there's some great stuff. And the playing on it is so great. Elton's singing, his harmonies. I mean, he sounds like Bobby V or the Everly Brothers on that track. But nobody got it, although it was a massive hit in America.
It was, well, no one had really, except for maybe McCartney with Oh Darling, no one had learned how to pastiche rock and roll yet.
Yeah. Exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
And a lot of people really thought, ah, oh, here we go, another lot. They've sold out again. They didn't get the fact that it was our little ode to rock and roll, because, you know, it was great. But I loved the whole album.
But the thing that was in the air, Davey, at the time was American Graffiti, right? So that American Graffiti had come out, and everyone was suddenly
timing was really good, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because the album cover was great.
But it's also... Another reason why you, I mean, it's very relevant, you talking about documenting the times, is how fast you move. Because Elton was locked into this ludicrous deal where you had to make an album every 6 months.
And we were doing it.
Just the sheer amount. Yeah, you were. You were absolutely doing it.
Yeah, it was album.
An incredible amount of quality material to be putting out.
Well, that's all we did. It was album, tour, separate single, album, tour, you know, separate single again. That's another thing. Quite a few of the singles that we released, especially in the UK, went on the album. You know, they were like Philadelphia Freedom wasn't on an album back then. And Step Into Christmas, that Christmas song, which, again, if you listen to that track, that's a smoking little track. You know, it's become one of those underground things that people say, oh, please play that. And Elton will go, no bloody way, I'm not playing that. But it's a great little track. But we did a lot of separate things at that point that weren't on albums, and that was another thing we were trying to give back. Even then, we were trying to give back.
Like, for instance, having to do a song for a film, which I really, really want to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'll tell you what, right? What's so funny is that because that part in, we'll get to the song in a second, because that part is actually played on a bass, but what you play on the guitar on Pinball Wizard is A, how we always think of Pete Townsend, and that's what everyone heard in their head who ever heard that song.
Which is John, yeah.
They heard the Who's.
Because you're talking about John Entwistle's.
That guitar that you.
John Entwistle did the Yagadang bit, didn't he, on that?
Yeah. No, he did the da-dang.
Da-dang. Well, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But everyone in their head has that down as Townsend going, great.
I know.
And you did it. You did it.
And you played it.
With
you
a proper have, big fat Les Paul sound. It was.
You really, played it tonight.
I was
tonight.
So happy when I heard that.
You did it, Ron. You've played it tonight. But yeah. It's true. It was because when we did that, obviously Pete was there. And Keith was in the control.
What was that like? What was it like having...
amazing. But again, I think that shows what we were doing at the time. We were a particular kind of band. All we did was we were playing, writing, touring, album, the whole thing, as I said. So when it came to the thing of, Elton said to me, oh, we've been asked to do a track on Tommy. And I'm going, oh, what track? And he said, Pinball Wizard. I was like, okay, hands down. I mean, hello. All right, thanks. So my immediate idea was, I'm going to have an open tuning guitar. I'm going to tune it to G. And we'll do it in C, but so I can go ba-da.
Because Pete's wasn't
exactly.
Pete's wasn't
so
yeah yeah.
And Pete's wasn't open tuned, right?
Well, we did it recently.
Pete's
wasn't open tuned.
It was something.
No, but Pete doesn't play that part.
No,
Pete doesn't play it at all.
Sorry,
it's just bass. It's single note.
It's all acoustic guitar.
It's only single note on the
acoustic
original.
Guitar. Pete's playing on that track. It's all acoustic.
Yeah,
and it's brilliant. I mean. So we took the background vocal parts that Pete played on the beginning of the guitar. We used that as the intro. But he loved the fact that we were giving it our take on it, that I was playing.
Oh, and also, because also, I'm sorry, because at the end, rather than going into the I always thought was a bit weird, where the Who's version sort of drifts off. You go into this kind of, it's like Bowie's version of Can't Explain, where you go into like the most archetypal Who riff,
yeah,
but with proper boots as big as Elton wears in the
slow
film
down.
On.
they loved that. And that was something that just happened on the spur of the moment, because we'd never worked out before we got to the studio. We hadn't worked out a thing about what we were going to do. That was the way that our band always has worked. You know, we'd get there, plug in. All right, bang, let's do it. And I knew in my head what I was going to do. And everybody else kind of did. Like Dee's part was based on, obviously, what John Entwistle played. Mm-mm. God bless him, another one. Yeah, and that was what we went for, was that Who thing. But as you were saying about what I played, wasn't ever Pete's part, but he loved it. But the same goes for Elton's piano part. You never heard... You heard right? It was all his chordal thing, but we made it ours, and I think that's what made our band so important. If we were doing something else, same with Lucy in the Sky, we'd make it our version, you know, not just another version of that song.
But what Guy was talking about, and the quality and the depth, you know, you're making pop music. I mean, there seems, you know. There's pop music now, and then there's serious music. You were making something that was both, you know, the depth in the lyrics and the depth in the musicianship and the depth in Elton's vocals and you know what he was singing about. That's a given, right? That I'm just saying that because it's true. What I want to know are two things: is how fast were you sitting there when Elton would get a sheet of lyrics in front of him and go, right, what's the scansion on this? How do I make this work? And how did it work? And how quickly could he sing those vocals and put them down?
You wouldn't believe how fast the whole process was. It was ridiculous. I mean, right from the beginning, literally, he would sit down. Let's say the Chateau, for example, where we first came together as a band. He would come down. He'd be first there. He'd be sitting at his piano. I would come down, get some coffee, get a bit of baguette and go over to him. And I remember vividly, for example, when he started writing Honky Cat. I mean, he started doing this funky piano stuff and I've always been amazed and I loved that style of his thing. And within 15 minutes, he'd have the song. And during that time, I'd be listening and I'd go, well, banjo would be good on that. Immediately, Dee would sit down and he would sit in and you get to the chorus, get back, honky cat, and Dee would be bum bum, gong gong, gong gong, And Nigel will be right there with the same sensibility. So when people talk about magic being created in the studio, that's really what this was. And the same applied with every single song that we did. I mean, literally, we stopped practicing stuff in the breakfast room at the Chateau because it was too quick. We'd have three songs immediately. We'd have to move all the gear over to the studio. So we just stayed in the studio the whole time. Elton would get a lyric from Bernie.
And you never got to have breakfast either.
Well, we've always been a band that would start very workmanlike. You know, we would always start working early, like 11 a.m., no matter how late we all stayed up. But I mean, we'd always start about 10:30 or 11 recording, playing, and then work till about 7 o'clock at night, and then all have dinner together. So it was always that kind of family thing. But going back to the time things took, it always happened that way, all the way into all the records. But for example, when we did, I guess that's why they call it the blues, which I'm very happy to say that I'm a co-writer on that.
Yeah.
Elton asked me in Montserrat, he said, I want to write this song. And I'd seen the lyric. It's on a very rare occasion. Bernie had showed me the lyric because we'd flown together from LA to Montserrat. And we were getting a bit out of it on the plane and there was a delay and stuff. And I said, Bernie, give us a look, you know, can I have a look at, give us a butcher's. And he kind of went, no, I never show anybody. But after about six Bloody Marys each and finally getting to Miami, you know, 4 hours late, he said, oh, all right. And he showed me some of the lyrics. I mean, I'm a huge Bernie.
And you immediately went, banjo.
I'm a massive Bernie fan. Bernie Taupin's work, yeah. And as Gary was talking about at the beginning of his wind-up here with that question, Bernie's stuff is such a monstrously huge part of this whole thing, obviously, because when you get a lyric to start off with, that's what you start with. And very, very rarely did it happen the other way, where Elton would have an idea and he'd ask Bernie to write a lyric. It only happened a couple of times. But with Blues, I'd seen the lyric and I knew how beautiful it was. So when Elton said to me in the studio, I really want to write this just with guitar. What do you think? And I'm like, yeah. So we sat down, the two of us opposite each other, me with an acoustic, him just sitting there with the lyric. And we wrote it in 15 minutes. And Bernie's work, and I think Elton would wholeheartedly agree with this, there's something about it that makes you think of a certain image, or all this imagery comes to mind. And it's not
just... Well, he's very cinematic. I mean, even with very overt references, yeah, but yeah.
Exactly. It's not just, you know, yeah. I love you, baby, you are. It's really more like, you know, a story and a picture.
You'd go inside and outside, wouldn't you? One minute you'd be next to them in the bed, as it were, and then you'd be outside looking at the weather, you know, and...
That's it. I mean, God bless that whole thing. And again, I put it down to that magic that I was talking about. I don't think anything in music happens without magic. I really don't think it does.
But I love that, like the thing that you know, that Elton and Bernie have never ever been in the same room when it happened. And so, and I can see how that probably happened for a bit. Then it probably became a superstition, didn't it? That they can never be in the same room. Because they probably could.
Yeah. But are they never, Davey? Was he never there?
No, they've never been in the same room, right?
Well, I think there's actually has been the odd occasion. I'm trying to think when that might be. But
no,
I don't.
You killed everything.
No, but I don't. No, you're right. You're right, Guy. But I think there might have been the odd occasion later on in the thing when they had to do different projects, when maybe something would happen where. Because it went on from being the rock and roll thing and the albums to plays, to musicals, to movies, to different things. Right. So I think occasionally Elton's so respectful of Bernie's stuff. And you're right, it's very rare that they'd be in the same room. But Elton would always call Bernie if there was something he wasn't unsure about. It might even be if there was an and in the line that he wanted to put in. He would call Bernie up in LA and say, I wanted to change that to... Is that okay? And Bernie would go, yeah, I don't care. Yeah.
Let's talk about Yellow Brick Road. I mean, just... you know, we're talking...
That's the one for... I've got to say, that's the one for me, Davey. That was one of the first albums.
Because there's nothing wasted on that you know,
an ounce of fat.
Did you go in knowing it was a double album? How did that happen?
Probably the most fun we've ever had in the studio together. It was so much fun doing that record. Because at that point, we were kind of given license to do whatever we wanted. It was already quite obvious to us that we were up there, we were the thing, you know. So it wasn't going to our heads. It just meant we're going to have a great time with this. We're going to record as much as we want and do whatever, you know. The idea actually had been to record a double album before we even went to France for that record. I think the original working title was something like Silent Pictures Talking Movies, something like that. But the idea was a very cinematic deal, given Bernie's penchant for writing such incredible stories.
The songs are full of it.
So we had all these great stories and all these characters in different colours. And
Danny Bailey.
It was a concept of the silver screen.
Yeah. And it was just something that, this is going to be so much fun. And we just loved it. And everything about doing all the backgrounds, you know, it was something that we'd become very good at doing. So like harmony, doing all those background vocals for that part. And just, it was almost like the pinnacle of all these things that we had learned together, to do together. We were kind of, okay, here's the whole picture. And it really was like that. It was such a fun, I always think of it as being a yellow record because of there's a kind of sunlight around the whole thing. It's kind of, it, you know, the album cover reflected it perfectly, I thought. The whole thing, that cover, and very special for us and very special for, I think, all the people who bought the record and held it in their hands as a real piece of art.
There's an interesting thing because, you know, this was an album about a bygone era when the medium was the silver screen, as it were. And there's a sense when you went out, it was a full circle. Here was Elton really in an age where rock and roll, the golden age, is almost the bygone era.
Yeah, I mean, phenomenal stuff. Because, I mean, here's the other thing, I think. Elton, as far as I'm concerned, is a really true, you know, rock and roll icon. I thought it right from the beginning because of my own appreciation of people like the Beatles, the Stones, Elvis, the Kinks, people that we heard, but also people like Joni Mitchell or the Incredible String Band. And when I found out, when I first met Elton and we talk about what we liked, he'd be like, oh, shit, I love Wee Tam and the Big Huge. And I was like going, wow, this guy knows who they are. And he knows who Joni is and this kind of thing. And he appreciates the whole gamut. He appreciates, classical music. He played me some stuff early on. Again, I was kind of amazed that he was aware of, you know, really obscure. Like he played me Albinoni. It was an adagio. I actually did a recording of it back in the 80s, just playing with Nicky Hopkins playing piano and a guy from Steppenwolf playing organ. So
that's
playing stuff that changed my mind a couple of times, you know. So I think that's the reason that we always got on, because we've always been so excited about different people in our industry. And although we loved what we were doing, we never took it, how do I put this? We never took it that seriously. We loved what was happening. But it was like, okay, we're doing this and that's great, but have you heard this?
Can I tell one little story about the one time I recorded with Elton?
Do.
Which was, I played on, just one sort of Trust Me, on the El Dorado. But the day I went into the studio, it was with Pat Leonard.
Right.
My dear friend was producing it. Right. But the day I went in was the day after the Brits, when Craig David had been nominated for every single award, pretty much, and hadn't won a single one. And Elton was livid. He was absolutely furious on Craig David's behalf, which was really brilliant and really honourable of him, but really awful for me.
Brilliant story.
Brilliant.
I love that.
Saturday,
this shows the way he was about championing people and the way
Saturday night
genuinely offended.
Davey, Saturday night's all right for fighting. I mean, you know, the guitar part in that, I grew up loving that as a young guitarist.
Oh, thanks, mate.
I had the privilege.
You played on it with me one night, a couple of nights.
He remembers. I played on it a couple of nights in Dublin. I think maybe a couple of nights at Wembley Arena.
That's right.
What a thrill that was. But That was such a great guitar part. I mean, now you talk about writing and Elton, and there's a, you're not co-writing credit on that. It's such a big part of it. I mean, how did that track come together?
Well, ironically, we'd gone down to Jamaica to record the kind of the follow-up to Don't Shoot Me, I guess. And all everything's happening, and we thought, let's have a change. We'll try Jamaica, where, you know, the Wailers and all that. Oh, it would be great. We'll go down there. So we went down to Kingston, and we went into the studio. Gus and Ken went into the studio, and the guy who ran the studio was called Carlton, and he was a great guy. And we knew we were in trouble when Gus walked into the main recording studio, and there was no gear in there.
Right.
And Gus said,
Soon come.
Gus said, you know, where's all the equipment? You know, we're going to start in a couple of days. And the guy shouted out, Carlton, get the microphone. And that was it. You know,
that was all they had.
They had to order gear from Miami, and that was another few days. So we ended up getting hammered for a week, you know, on the local ganja and having fun and just laughing the whole time. So when we actually got started, we realized it wasn't going to be suitable. And we did record a track of Saturday Night. And it really, Elton has described it in the past as sounding like a swarm of angry bees, because it was so thin. The sound was so weedy and thin. But here's the cool part. When we decided, okay, that's it, we can't do this here, let's go back to the chateau. We got to the chateau because we knew we're on home ground, you know. So we all knew the song. But Elton said, look, I just want to do it. I don't want piano on it. Let's just do it full on guitar song. Great. So it was on me to come up with the intro, the whole part, and do the whole thing. And while we were doing it, and it happened very, very quickly. I think it was like the second take. So the intro I came up with was really just out of nowhere. I think what makes it sound so cool is the fact that I layered so many guitars, you know, on the intro, and then laid out during the verses, added some more parts in the chorus, some kind of Lennon-y parts. And then for the solo section, when it's just guitars, it's right in your face because I added another four guitars. And so by the solo section, there's like 12 guitars rocking out, you know. And I actually used, for those guitar aficionados, apart from my Les Paul, I used...
I was going to say, that is actually, you do have to tell us that.
Oh, yeah. It's two Les Pauls, one the old gold top, old 1963, and then my three pickup custom, Black Beauty, which I use on the other tracks. And but amps, I used AC30s, and then I used Fender Champs, the little practice amps.
Oh, yeah.
I used like four of them.
Right.
But we recorded it so that the needles were pinned, and it just sounds, whoa, when it comes in. So yeah, it was so much fun. And while we were doing the track, Elton was just dancing around the studio with a microphone. Come on, you bastards. And, you know, and just Dee and Nigel and me doing it. And here's the classic. After I spent maybe an hour doing all the guitar parts, because it was one after another, bang, bang, bang. And it sounded amazing. And Elton said, that's it. And I said, look, man, you got to put piano on it. And Gus said the same thing. And he's going, no, I'm not going to put piano on it. And I said, look, please. So we were like pleading with him. Look, when it gets to the solo, just do one of your glissandos. And he did. And so when that piano comes in, it's like,
yeah,
that's kind of, for me,
don't give
a really magic
of your
part of it. Here confusion. He comes, you know, Mr. Piano icon.
Yeah.
And to this day, it's become the track that everybody relates to, which is bizarre because it wasn't a massive hit, you know.
Really? I mean, such a privilege to play on stage with you that time. But what I do remember, I'm surprised. Your memory is amazing, by the way, amazing. But and I'm surprised because I went to a few of your after show parties. Mm. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Right. So those ones in Dublin.
I mean,
let's just, you know. You partied hard, you guys, didn't you?
Oh, man. And, you know, you were there several of those nights. And I remember Joe Elliott being there a couple of nights and those guys. And And we had drunk the hotel out in Ireland, in Dublin, out of Guinness.
The Westbury, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We drunk it out of Guinness. So they had to send to another hotel.
That gets you a plaque, doesn't it, on the wall?
Yeah. That's right. And Joe said, he said, how often do you guys do this? And we looked at each other and went, every night? And it really was like that in those days. And, you know, those were danger years. So thankfully, you know, a few years after that, Elton was able to sort himself out and deal with it in the most honourable and the most honest and the most direct way, as most of you have all heard that story. But yeah, those times were crazy. They were dangerous. It's only our stamina that allowed us to weather that whole period, you know, and carry on playing.
He sort of, am I right to think this, that he split the band as part of his cleaning up process? What happened?
Yeah, he had to just basically...
People, places and things.
Yeah, exactly. He had to get away. He had to do his thing and be away. And I was so happy for him that he was doing it. I was surprised, but I was so happy for him at that period because it was just so traumatic. I mean, I think the last record... leading up to that time when he said, I need to have a break, was Sleeping With the Past, which it's got some great stuff on it. Mm. And by then we were working with my dear friend, Chris Thomas, who produced several of the great albums.
Mate, yeah.
Yeah.
I spoke to him just the other day.
Oh, did you?
In fact.
Yeah. I love Chris. And
Chris, can I just say, Chris, Anarchy in the UK, one of the best guitar sounds on any record.
Absolutely. When I heard that, I was blown away. And they did that in, a day? Yeah. The whole album. Mm-mm. Like, insane, you know. And, loved that. I love Jonesy as well, you know. He's a great guy.
So, but you're... I mean, can I ask a personal question? Because, obviously, you were partying as well.
Absolutely.
And that was a longer process for you to let go.
Absolutely. I think, you know, until you realise... properly come to your senses that this is probably not the way to carry on if you want to live any longer. And again, I was given a lot of help in that area by my dear friend Elton. You know, he was actually the first one who gave me a nudge, and we were sitting at his place one day. I'd been staying there for a few days and we're having breakfast and having some cup of tea and toasted marmalade or something. And out of the blue, he looked up from his newspaper and he said, you know what, I think you should probably have a look at what you're doing with your drinking and everything else that you're doing. And then carried on reading. And I would kind of look back, I said, what? And I did what every person in that situation tends to do, which was, what, me? I'm fine. What about the drummer? He's much worse than me. That kind of thing, you know. And he went, no, you're my friend and I'm talking about you. And it was like a jolt, a real jolt. And I went back to California a few days later and really thought deeply about what he said. Obviously, when your closest friend says something like that, if you don't listen, then you really, you know, forget about it. Luckily, I did. And I was very fortunate to meet a lot of other friends of mine who'd done the same thing. And I cleaned up entirely. So it's been wonderful because it's helped my playing. It's helped my family, my children, my wife and I. It's helped the whole thing. Mm. Everything has gotten better, you know. And it's been a gift that I've been given. And I accepted it wholeheartedly. Because I think life is too fleeting, as we've seen. Too many people that we've seen due to, you know, substances or whatever, just behavior in general, we've lost them. You know, we don't have Kurt Cobain anymore. We don't have Amy. We don't have so many of those amazing people, Tom Petty, Prince, who have gone way too soon because of some ridiculous, you know.
There's also just the thing, Davey, I'd say that when I look back on a lot of times I had, it's the thing of wanting to be present.
Absolutely.
When you suddenly think there was a lot of those amazing things that happened and you could have really been there.
That's right.
And maybe you weren't, you know?
Well, you know what? Again, you mentioned my memory the other day, and I do have a phenomenal memory. I'm blessed with that. Let's pray that, you know, that doesn't go. But thankfully, as far as all the gigs we've done over the years, I haven't forgotten anything. I mean, I remember being out of it on stage playing certain concerts. I really do. But I remember, you know, those events. I remember Elton and I being so whacked out of it. There was a concert where he tried to push his piano off stage. Now, it's difficult to push a piano off stage. Not very easy at all. This is a 3-ton instrument or something. But you know what? He had so much strength given by whatever the hell he was doing with his life that he was able to raise this thing up. So he's pushing the piano off stage and the crew are at the other side pushing it back, trying to stop it going into the audience and killing several people. I mean, this kind of thing is unbelievable, but I mean, this is the kind of thing, you know, this is how stupid the behavior can become. So things like that, I'm glad I remember them because I remember them and I go, God, I'm so glad we're not there anymore. And I found that most people who've had the gift of recovery, that's the thing that they say most is, thank God we're not doing that anymore. Jesus Christ, you know, One thing is how we ever managed to survive, but thank God we don't have to deal with all that anymore. And that's true. It's a freedom that I've been given that I never knew existed. And now I'm really grateful for that.
I know exactly what you're saying, Davey, and I'm wholeheartedly with you.
Glastonbury was amazing, wasn't it?
That crowd, I mean,
because the demographic was so huge.
I know. You know,
I mean, not only was it the biggest
crowd. Well, it's the biggest crowd there's ever been at that stage, isn't it?
We keep hearing stuff like that. All I know is that I've never felt that much love coming at us at one time. And then coupled with the fact of starting that whole thing with Pinball Wizard and be able to go on it to somebody, here we go, ba-da, you know, was suddenly like, all right, we get to do this. Mm-hmm. We get to do this for these amazing people. I mean, we were seeing banners in the audience and you're seeing people, icons, Paul McCartney and Slash and, you know, Dave Grohl and people who were, Rick Astley, my dear friend. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rick and I have been friends forever and both are...
That's what you played on an album of his back in 2005, didn't you?
Did I? I might have done.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we've been dear friends and
we love Rick.
We are.
What's that about the memory?
We love Rick.
Okay. Yeah. I'll have to talk to Rick about that one. He may have put my name on the album and not told me.
Friendship, but, Davey Johnstone.
Yeah, brilliant. I mean, he's one of my dearest friends. And I thought he killed it at Glastonbury. His set,
absolutely,
playing drums
in
on
so many
Highway
ways.
To Hell.
In so many ways. Yeah,
phenomenal. And I, when I see somebody like Rick having that success today that he's having, it's like, wow. And it's so well-deserved. I mean, Rick is brilliant. His band is brilliant. In fact, I'm coming over in November to see a couple of his gigs at the Albert Hall or whatever he's playing. As part of his Christmas type thing he does over there.
Great.
Oh, but can we just tell a quick story, David? Because we had him on here and he was just adorable. And in our preamble, we said, because we'd had a big run of things where prog seemed to be the recurring thing with the podcast. And we said, I think we can agree that this is one this is one episode where we're not going to be hearing anything about prog rock. He comes on, first thing he says, first gig I saw, Camel.
Man. He's such a great drummer. You know, he's totally, that's it, rock and roll, you know. He gets it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why he's become such a close friend of the Foo Fighters, because, I mean, he's been a massive fan of them anyway. And Dave Grohl always loved Rick. So when they actually met up and they realized that they wanted to do a version of Never Gonna Give You Up the way they play it and Rick was going to sing it, that kind of thing happening, I love those kind of things. You know, where those hybrid things happen, you think, what a weird thing to... But it makes sense to me that Rick should be such a close friend of those guys because he's a monster. Mm-hmm. He's a genuine monster of rock, you know. And I put him up there with everybody. He's the greatest.
What do you, sweetest man. But do you think Elton... He's going to do one-off shows, surely, at some point. Because his voice was so good. It's not like he's retiring because his voice has gone.
His voice is amazing, isn't it? I mean, he's just got...
Amazing.
He's suddenly now got this giant, big, full-bodied thing that's going on, you know. And
Paul Robeson,
awesome.
Kind of.
No, he's always got that. I mean, he's just one of the most amazing singers to this day. That you know, he's up there with anybody. Always will be, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest. You know.
Thank you, Davey. Oh my God. You know what? I could.
I just want to say one thing, because you did have this incredibly, because you know, there's all the work you did with other people,
Alice Cooper.
Hundreds of people, Alice Cooper, and I was desperately hoping that with all this stuff in the 80s, I was desperately hoping there'd be something somewhere that we played on together, and we never played on the same song, but you and I have played on one album together.
Okay.
Which is A Spanner in the Works by Rod Stewart. We're both on that.
Brilliant. Wow. I love that. Oh, fantastic guy. Well, I tell you what, I've played with you on record. I've played with Gary a couple of times live, and I love both you guys, and I love what you guys are doing. And I'm really looking forward to finding out about this Pink Floyd stuff you're doing. As I call you guys now, The Rock on Tour.
Saw that on our Instagram. That was so nice.
Awesome.
I can't wait.
Because, you know, I mean, those guys, I mean, I've always loved Pink Floyd stuff. I love David. I love his playing. Who doesn't? You know, what they've given to music. Yeah. I mean, unbelievable.
Davey, let's try and meet up when we're in the same town together.
Absolutely.
I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to seeing you guys again in the flesh. And I'll be over, as I said, in the winter, early winter, November. I'm getting some honor from the Scottish Music Awards in early November. So I'm going to come over a week early, see Rick and a few of my mates in London. So I'll be around, and then I'll be around after that for a week in London. I'm just going to get together with some mates. So hopefully I can see you guys.
We'd love to see you. This has been just a joy from beginning to end. An absolute joy.
Thanks so much for having me on, guys. It's brilliant. I'm really honoured.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All the best, sir. Oh, I mean, I love that. That was one of my favourites. I can't help it.
One of my absolute favourites. Could have just gone on and on and on. I mean, if you look at, we actually talked about very few.
I know. You know, I'm always slightly wary of the time, and I know people, we'll have to get him back on, but you know, there's that thing, if I know, as a podcast listener, if I look down, I see 2 hours for a podcast, I'm always sort of like not sure.
But there's also the thing, Gary, like, I have a real problem with biopics, or biopics, I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Which is the whole, when there's the whole career. The good ones are always when someone, like the Laurel and Hardy one, you pick an event in someone's life and you make a film about that. And that tells you, that's much better way of telling their story because you have time to get into the character. And I think when we do that, that's better for our listeners. And they don't need to have the whole chronological beginning to end. They need the essence of who that person
is. I mean, we
is.
Miss Caribou and the, you know, and all of, you know, I mean, you know, There's a lot there, and we
like I said, you know, this guy, I mean, there's no one else we've had on who was making 2 albums a year all the way through the 70s.
The product is incredible. What a nice man. I absolutely love it. You know what I've got to do now? My wife has gone up to Edinburgh to take our boy back to uni, and I can hear the dog going crazy already. I don't know if you picked up on that, but I've got my 11-year-old and 14-year-old who are waiting to be fed. So we'll be back next week with another rock hero of some sort or another, I'm sure.
Indeed. So thank you to Ian, our producer, and for all of you for listening. And it's good night from me.
Good night from him.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.